Dan, thank you so much for being here today on the podcast. Really appreciative of your time being here. And I've got to say, your works, your books have had a huge impact and influence in my own life. And I talked to a few people this week, actually even someone on a plane, saying, because I was reading, I had Drive on the plane, and they said, oh, I love that book. Dan Pink's amazing. I said, you know, I'm actually interviewing him this week. They're like, no way, that's incredible. Tell Dan that he's had a huge impact in my business. So
wow.
I hear that from many people, but it was kind of a cool experience this week, you know, prepping for this. So again, thank you so much for being on the podcast today.
Yeah, what a pleasure. And each time I hear something like that, it keeps me in the writing business for another week.
Yeah, that's awesome. So I think the challenge, Dan, one of the challenges is having you on the podcast to say which of your books should we highlight? You've written so many great ones and many what I would consider to be paradigm shifting. But today we're gonna focus mainly on the book Drive. And then at the end, we'll also highlight another book you have coming out soon. But I was actually curious, speaking of writing, I know from what I gathered, you originally went to law school, became a lawyer, and worked some in politics. So did you always think you were going to be an author, a book writer? Is it something you aspired to, or how did that, I guess, happen in your life?
I actually wasn't anything that I aspired to or that I thought was going to happen. It was weirder than that. As you mentioned, I went to law school. I actually never practiced law, but I did end up working in politics against my better judgment because at that time when I was much younger, that's what I was keenly interested in. But the weird thing is that I was always, quote unquote, writing on the side. From the time that I was in high school, I was writing on the side. So I would write, magazine columns and newspaper op-eds when I was in high school. And then when I was in college, I was a hardcore social science major. I majored in linguistics, which is a very mathematical social science. And yet I also ended up bizarrely like winning a short story prize. When I was in law school, I probably spent more time writing newspaper op-eds than I did law school papers. When I was even working in politics, I was writing on the side and in many cases, because of ethics laws, not even getting paid for it. And so it took me a while to realize that what I was doing on the side was what I should be doing, you know, in the center. And so, you know, it took me really into my early 30s to discover that I was a writer, for better or worse.
That's interesting. I'm always fascinated by a lot of the authors I have on the podcast and how it all started for them. And it seems like there's some similar narratives that happen where it's a realization one day. It's like, you know what, this may be something I need to do or I have a talent for. So,
yeah, for me, it's a very, very interesting question. So for me, I think that the lesson one can extract from that is that you should watch what you do. Okay, like pay attention to what you do. And so for me, this is one reason why I don't like the question, what's your passion? Because if you were to ask me at any stage in my life, is writing your passion? I would say no, because it's so difficult. But it's what I do. I almost can't help myself. And I think that ends up being a lesson, sort of watch what you do when no one is watching. Watch what you do when you have discretionary time. What do you think about when you're not thinking about other aspects of your life and your work? And I also find that in general, most people, their path to whatever it is that they do is twisty, to put it mildly. Sometimes often circuitous, sometimes with all kinds of backward steps and utterly, utterly nonlinear. And that's life.
And it sounds, what you just said sounds very similar as well to what Angela Duckworth said in her book Grit. We actually, she was one of the fourth episode on the podcast and said something very similar. And it's actually stuck with me. And it was actually one of, on LinkedIn, I shared the clip of that video and it had like tens of thousands of views and it resonated with so many people, this idea that, you know, your passion, it evolves and it comes to you over time, and it's not a linear path, right? So that's a great insight and something that's really resonated, at least people, you know, who have listened to this podcast before. So taking you back in time, so I know Drive was released 2009, so obviously you started working on it years before then. It's actually kind of funny. I was with my 11-year-old son the other night, and we were listening to Drive in the car.
Oh my God.
Yeah, well,
I hope Child Services doesn't hear this podcast.
I know. Well, they know. I've tried to involve them with this podcast, and they think it's kind of cool that there's these books. And so I always ask them, like, hey, so my son's name's Steven, too. I kind of didn't have much choice in that name. But I said, so Steven, I'm talking to Dan Pink tomorrow. What do you want me to ask him, you know, about human motivation? And he said, how do people research humans? So I thought it was kind of a funny question. But anyway, so when you're back 2009 or even before then, what made you want to understand human motivation? You know, what drives us?
Well, it was a few things. I had written a previous book called A Whole New Mind about the rise of, you know, metaphorically right brain thinking, and why SAT spreadsheet skills were becoming less valuable and artistic empathic skills were becoming more valuable. And, you know, one of my credos as a writer is that I think that books are conversations. And so I always welcome communication from readers and I try to respond to every single email from readers. And I started getting some questions about saying, well, if this is right, so how do you motivate people to do these kinds of things? Because it seems like a lot of the motivation for creative efforts or for empathic efforts or for big picture efforts come from within rather than from without. And I said, that's a really interesting question. And I started looking at some of the research I was vaguely aware of some of the research on motivation. And I started going into it more deeply. And I realized that what it was telling us, what the science was telling us, in many cases, directly contradicted a lot of what large organizations, from big companies to governments to schools, did. And I said, whoa, this is a little bit alarming. And if I can somehow close the mismatch, maybe I'm doing something good for the world.
It's actually one of the things you said in the book, that most businesses haven't caught up to this new understanding of what motivates us. So that was, you said that in 2009. I mean, how do you feel about that now? Do you feel like there's been some progress made, or do you still see a pretty big gap?
I mean, you know, it's like that old adage, you know, it's not where it ought to be, but it's not where it used to be. So that's some progress. So I think there is a recognition of some of I think it's less of a recognition of the underlying science, which we can talk about, and it's more of a recognition that the old mechanisms just aren't working very well. And that if you deploy some of these newer mechanisms, they're actually more effective. So it's less like organizations are convinced by the brilliant clarity and sophistication of my arguments, and more they're basically hit a wall in their own lives and said, this is just totally not working. What else can I do?
Right. And then in the book, you articulate really well kind of the different, you call it motivation 1.0, motivation 2.0. I wonder if you may talk a little bit about these different levels of motivations. You term them like operating systems, which I love. But
one of the interesting things about motivation, and to your son's question, which I think is actually a very insightful question of like, how do you study human beings? It's tough to study human beings, in part because you can't draw perfect, pristine conclusions about human beings in the way you could in, say, elementary physics. You roll a ball down an inclined plane on planet Earth, you can pretty much predict what's going to happen. We have a set of underlying principles that are uniformly true. And, you know, whereas human beings, it's a lot more complex. Human beings are complicated and sophisticated and complex. So let me explain what I mean by that. So I use that nomenclature in part because human beings are a mix of drives, okay? So we have a biological drive. We eat when we're hungry. We drink when we're thirsty, right? We have sex to satisfy those carnal urges. So biological drives are part of what it is to be a human being. But no one would ever say they're all that it is to be a human being. We you know, and again, this is no one of any faith or any lack of faith would ever say that. We'd say, well, wait a second, we're more complex than that. So there's another layer, which is a second drive, which is that human beings do respond to rewards and punishments in their environment. That in many cases, if you reward behavior, you will get more of it. And you punish behavior, you will get less of it. So that second drive is the basis of an operating system that has been widely used in companies and schools and other kinds of organizations. However, all of us would agree that human beings also have another drive. We do things because we like doing them. We do things because they help us grow. We do things because it's the right thing to do. We do things because they make a contribution to the world. And that's also part of what it is to be a human being. But in many cases, the way we run organizations has stopped at that second drive and not taken a three-dimensional view of who human beings are. So that's on the broad spectrum. I can also, and then what we also have, Stephen, is you know, 50, 60 years now of research telling us what is effective in motivation and what is not. And it's actually, it's nuanced, but it's actually fairly easy to state. And here's, and I can give you the summary. I mean, I can save everybody the trouble of reading, you know, the first several chapters of the book, because I can, you know, there's a punchline here, which is this. If you look at the research in human motivation, here's what it says pretty clearly. There is a certain kind of motivator that we use in organizations. Psychologists call it a controlling contingent motivator. Too many words for me. I like to call it an if-then reward, as in if you do this, then you get that. If you do this, then you get that. Here's what 60 years now of social science tells us. If-then rewards are very effective for simple tasks with short time horizons. Why? Human beings have that second drive. We like rewards. We like them a lot. You dangle a reward in front of some of anybody, you got my attention. You've got my attention in this very narrow focused way. That's very good if the task is algorithmic. That is, if you're following a recipe, following a set of rules, marching down a set of steps to a clear conclusion. If then rewards are pretty effective for simple tasks with short time horizons. But the same body of research tells us that if then rewards are less effective for complex tasks with long time horizons. And the reason is the same. Human beings love rewards. We have that second drive. You dangle a reward in front of somebody, you have their attention in that narrow focused way. That's good for simple tasks, but for complex tasks, for creative tasks, when you don't even know what the task is, when you're trying to figure out what the question is, you don't want to approach it narrowly. You want to have an expansive view. And so what we have is we have this operating system built on that second drive, saying that if then rewards are the way to motivate people. And that's true for some things. But if you look at the workforce today, an increasing portion of what we do on the job is not simple, routine, algorithmic, and short term. That kind of work is increasingly being automated. So what more people are doing on the job is work that requires more judgment, creativity, discernment, conceptual thinking. And what we need is a different operating system for motivating people to do those kinds of tasks.
It's very, very well said. And so that's why there's the need for the motivation 3.0, as you term it. So just a recap for my purposes, just helpful. So motivation 1.0 is basically, it's all about survival. Biological drives. Yep. Motivation 2.0 is this external rewards and punishments, the if then type of thing. And then, and you're not saying, I take it that you're not saying that obviously there's not a place for if then rewards, like something like a salary, right? I mean, you're not going so far as to say like, oh, there can't be a carrot and a stick. But what you're saying is that just shouldn't be the fundamental driver in people's lives. Is that what you're saying?
This is an extremely important point that you're getting at here. Extremely important. And once again, it's nuanced. So here's the thing. The problem with if-then rewards is that if-then rewards are a contingency. The problem with if-then rewards is not the reward. It's the contingency, the if-then-ness of it. Because if-then-ness is a form of control. And human beings have only two reactions to control. They comply or they defy. So you can do simple algorithmic work if you're compliant. It's very difficult to do complex creative work if you're just compliant. So that's one thing. The second thing is that I would argue that salaries are. Well, let's even put a finer point on it. Let's just talk directly about money rather than salaries per se. The research does not say money is not a motivator. Human beings don't care about money. That they do. Human beings care about money. Money is a motivator. I want to make that very, very clear, because what I've seen in some cases is some organizations say, oh, wait a second. It's all about these intrinsic motivators. It's all about this, these innate capacity and the desire to grow and flourish and be autonomous and have a purpose. Great, I can scrimp on people's salaries and recompensate them in units of bliss. Bad idea. Money matters. Money matters. But it matters in a way that is slightly more nuanced. Here's what the research tells us very clearly. Even from one of the very first organizational motivation researchers, Hedrick Hertzberg, like 70 years ago, money is a threshold motivator. It's a threshold motivator. So if you want to come up with a motivational regime that provides enduring motivation for complex creative tasks, you start out by this: pay people enough, pay people well. If you don't pay people well, you're not going to get through that threshold. Human beings are exquisitely attuned to the norm of fairness. If you treat people unfairly, they're not going to be motivated. So if I am not getting a sufficient salary, if I'm getting less than other people doing my job, if I'm getting less than I deserve, I'm not going to be motivated. I'm not going to get through that threshold. So there's a paradox here. In many ways, the best use of money as a motivator is to pay people enough to take the issue of money off the table. Because what you want on more complex, if you want for simple tasks, raising the salience of money is actually smart. If I'm here at my desk and you want me to stuff a lot of envelopes, you should pay me per envelope and give me a bonus for every 50 envelopes I stuff. I will stuff more envelopes. All right. You want to raise the salience of money. But if you want me to come up with a great new business idea, if you want for me to devise a new advertising campaign, if you want me to write a cool new piece of software the world didn't even know it was missing, you actually don't want me thinking about the money. You want me thinking about the work. And one way to help people think about the work is to pay people enough to take the issue of money off the table. And so there's nuance. So I'm a big fan of hiring great people and paying them extremely well. Hire great people, pay them extremely well. You can use other kinds of variable comp, which I think needs to be very, very simple and tied to metrics that matter. But in general, hire great people, pay very high base salaries, and then, you know, focus on the elements that we know lead to enduring long-term motivation for complex tasks.
I think that's important with what you said. I know sometimes when people will read a book, and I'm not saying this is the case with Drive, but they'll read a book and it'll be like, oh, well, that's a really nice idea, but it's not in the, you know, this is not the real world that I'm dealing with. But that's not what you're saying in this. No. You're not saying that there's not a place for obviously for salaries, for being paid
for money. Let me be as clear as I can. Money matters. Money is a motivator. If you think that you can get away with paying, like scrimping on people's pay, and using and tapping only their intrinsic motivation, that's a very, 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 very difficult. That's a very, very difficult task. But at the same time, you also have to live. You know, I like your phrase about living in the real world, because the real world has evidence about what works and what doesn't. And there are a lot of organizations that are not living in the real world. They're living in a world that their leaders imagine is true, and perhaps desperately want to be true, but is actually not the real world, is a fantasy landscape. And what I would rather have is people living in the real world where we have evidence of what leads to enduring motivation, even though that evidence is, even though that evidence is nuanced.
And yeah, and it's interesting to kind of contemplate. And it makes a lot of sense that, and I like that you're saying it is nuanced. It's like a kind of like a spectrum on these different motivation scales, motivation 1.0, 2.0, 3.0. So this motivation 3.0 that you present, as I understand it, it's concerning itself less with these external rewards and more with kind of the inherent satisfaction that comes with the task. Is that, I guess you would articulate it better than that, but I guess what is motivation 3.0? What is that next level that so many businesses are missing?
So exactly. So here's what we know. All right. So you can. So first of all, you got to pay people enough, right? That's a threshold. Once you're through the threshold, it turns out there's a very interesting body of research telling us that there are, in general, three core motivators for long-term performance on these more complicated tasks, which are the tasks that most of us are doing. They are autonomy, mastery, and purpose. Autonomy is a sense of self-direction. Do you have some sovereignty over what you do, how you do it, when you do it, where you do it, how you do it, who you do it with, right? There's a whole line of research called self-determination theory that I write a lot about in this book. And self-determination theory starts with, what most of us think is the accurate premise about the human condition, which is that we are inherently self-directed, that we don't want to be controlled. We actually want some sovereignty over our life. And I think what the research has shown us is that in the workplace, when people have when people have control over the core aspects of their work, rather than when they're being controlled, they do better. They just simply do better work. So that's autonomy. Mastery is our desire to get better at stuff, to learn and to grow. There's some very compelling research showing that, I think it's human nature again, that human beings have an innate desire to want to learn and grow. I think that anybody with children realizes that when, you know, any young kid, first of all, any kid you see is going to be autonomous and self-directed. Any young kid you see is going to want to learn and grow. That's who we are as human beings. There's also some other very powerful research from Teresa Mabule at Harvard Business School showing that the single biggest day-to-day motivator on the job is making progress in meaningful work. And so mastery is, are you learning, growing, making progress, getting better at something that matters? And finally is purpose. And purpose is, to oversimplify just a bit, purpose is knowing why you're doing something, not simply how to do it. Is your work making a difference in the world, or is it simply, making a contribution somewhere? Are you a cook in a restaurant and your food is being enjoyed? Are you a customer service rep and you've actually solved somebody's problem? Are you working inside of an organization and today you helped a teammate get a project out the door? So human beings are motivated by a sense of purpose. And so again, pay people well, and then come up with environments where people can have a sense of autonomy, a sense of mastery, and a sense of purpose.
I love when you get to the purpose side, I think of an example that I think a lot of people have heard before of the three people working on a church building, and the first person, you know, says, I'm laying bricks, and then the second person says, well, I'm building a church, and then the third person is, I'm helping build the kingdom of God, type of thing, you know, in that example. So from a purpose. So there is one from each, from autonomy. One thing I wanted to just point out that I thought was really insightful and helpful. So one of the things you say in the book is that encouraging autonomy doesn't mean discouraging accountability.
Absolutely right.
Which I thought was really great to highlight, because again, with just from the practical side of things, just I think the initial reaction of, and I think it's getting better, but so many business leaders and management, it's like, oh, give my people autonomy. Like, well, you know, what does that mean? It's like, no, you're not. It's not like you're just throwing everything out the window. You still demand accountability, right? I mean, that's part of it.
Let me see you and raise you on that point. I would argue that for the very best people and the most important tasks, that autonomy is the pathway to accountability. That the best way for people to do great work and be accountable is to give them some freedom to do their jobs the way that they want to do them. We see this in the language of organizations. You and I talk to all these organizations all over the place, and you often hear complaints about micromanagement, right? Micromanagement is control. What I'm talking about is a term that has not taken off, but basically macro management. Help me understand what the goals are. Give me the resources I need and let me have at it. That's what high performers want. People are not, again, this is an empirical thing here too. Like, we know this, all right? So when people are most satisfied, their jobs are high in challenge and high in what's called decision latitude, which is, you know, think of that as autonomy. People are not happy in low challenge, in jobs that are not very challenging. People actually, the best people especially, want challenge. But if you put people in a challenging job where they don't have autonomy, they burn out. If you put people in a job that combines high challenge with high decision latitude, a job that is challenging and where people have some control over it, that's how people flourish.
I agree with everything you're saying. And so it's kind of from the autonomy side, from the mastery side, I like when you talk about getting in the flow zone or the zone, essentially. That's a great piece. And then the other part is on the mastery side that there's pain involved as well.
Oh yeah.
I think that's so good to hear, especially for younger people in their careers, that part of the path of mastery is having grit and doing this deliberate practice and you know, being able to be determined and work through things, but that you actually get fulfillment from that. It's not a, you know, a silver platter handed to you. It actually takes work. Whereas I think a false narrative that you see because of things like social media, where you just see an image of, oh wow, that's the perfect life, and you have so many people that are just looking on social media and saying my life is terrible because, you know, this false appearance that you can just put whatever you want on social media. And so
right.
that really resonated with me, and I think there are people in the younger generation that part of this, that the autonomy, I think people realize, but the mastery part, that there is, you know, there is a sense of you got to work at it a little. So that,
amen. I mean, yeah. And also, you know, in this book, I wrote about Angela Duckworth's research on grit, before her book came out. I mean, I wrote about her research, but yeah, mastery is a pain. You don't get to achieve mastery without some degree of suffering.
And then on the final one, purpose, the one story that you shared that I loved was the University of Rochester, where they tracked the people that were graduating, and they kind of looked at, there was people that they termed had what would be called a profit goal, which would be more like an extrinsic, mm-hmm. so something like money or wealth or title. And then there was other people that were graduating that their goals were more what they called purpose goals. I guess you mm-hmm. termed it a purpose goal. So it was more intrinsic. And so over the years, I guess what was, and I'm kind of drawing a blank a little bit, which terrible prep on my part, but I think it was years later when they followed up with them, the people that had more of the purpose goals had lower levels of depression and higher levels of just satisfaction compared to even the people that had the profit goals, even those that achieved those profit goals.
That's more or less right. And there's other research on this. There's an even better study that came out subsequently, done by Amy Wisniewski and Barry Schwartz, that looked at, I think this is a very instructive study, that it looked at, I think it was West Point. It was one of the military academies. I'm pretty sure it was West Point, one of the military academies. And what they showed, what they did is they measured the incoming students, and they said, who has essentially instrumental goals and who has fundamental goals. So why are you here? purely instrumental would be because I got 4 years of free education and that's a great deal. All right. Others of them are because I want to serve my country. Those are the two poles there. So instrumental is, yeah, I got a free ride. Of course I'm going to come here. And then the other one is, well, I'm here at West Point because I want to serve my country. And then there are people who are mixed. Many people who are mixed is like, yeah, I want to serve my country. And, you know, I couldn't turn down this free ride. Then they track what happened to see who is the most successful. And it turns out that the people who are least successful are the people with purely instrumental motives. That is, the people who said, like, oh, I want to get this free ride, actually ended up achieving far less. And the people who achieved the most were the people with these purely non-instrumental goals. I just want to serve my country. And even more than the people, like most of us, who have the combined thing. So there's a kind of a paradox in that, in some ways, the best way to achieve success is not to pursue success, but to pursue purpose, to pursue excellence, just to be great. And not focus too much on the external markers of that, but to focus on the thing itself. And in a weird way, the best way to get those external rewards, those external markers, is not to seek them. Because by not seeking them, by seeking something better, pure, deeper, you actually are significantly better at what you do.
And it reminds me very similar to some of the things my grandpa used to talk about. He used to talk about primary greatness and secondary greatness. So primary greatness being things like your character, your integrity, exactly, things like that. Whereas the secondary greatness are the things like the money, the titles, recognition. And it kind of tied into the same thing where you have the private victory over self precedes the public victory, like you were saying. So yeah, I think
David Brooks has a nice way of talking about this. He talks about resume virtues and eulogy virtues. What are the things that are on your resume, and what are the things people say about you once you're gone? And you know, I you and I are talking a week or so after the memorial service for Colin Powell. That memorial service was actually conducted literally just a few blocks from where I'm sitting right now. I live just a few blocks from the National Cathedral. And, you know, here's this incredibly accomplished man. This man, resume studded with all kinds of achievements. And the eulogies were about his character. The eulogies were about his integrity. They were about his kindness. They were about his sense of humor. They were about his ability to care for others. And I think that, you know, we can call it eulogy virtues, we can call it primary greatness. That, you know, at some level should be our life's pursuit. Now, again, we're tempted to take other roads here, and a lot of us might not at that. But I really am convinced, both in my experience as a human being on this planet, but also in looking at the research, that that's the move, man. Just be good, try to be great, and let the chips fall where they may.
And something else you talk about, and then we'll get to the final couple questions there, but something else you talk about, I think related to that, I think it's under mastery, is this idea that you never arrive.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask you about that. How have you dealt with that in your own life? Because I think it can be empowering, but also discouraging to kind of think, okay, I'm focused on these primary traits and character and greatness, but there's really never an end in sight for that. It's right. I wanted to ask you yourself, how have you personally dealt with that in your own life? Kind of that idea that you never arrive.
You know, it's something that I am reckoning with right now. Not so much the never arriving part, but the sense that one is plateauing and that one isn't actually moving toward greater and greater mastery. and what that might require for some of us, for many of us, where we have the opportunity is to actually take on a fundamentally different challenge, that is to shift domains entirely. So for me, it might be not writing another book, but doing something, you know, a little bit different, where I have a chance to ride that learning curve, have a steeper learning curve, and to feel a sense, you know, and essentially in a way start at a lower level. You know, if I plateaued at this level, it's actually jump off of that and start at the bottom somewhere else and ride the curve back up, which can be a daunting thing. But I really do think that, again, it depends on where you are in your life. You know, I'm in my mid 50s, so this is a conversation that I would have with myself today that I wouldn't have had 20 years ago. To be perfectly candid and transparent, you know, one thing that I think about in my own life right now is whether I make a bigger break to a totally different domain where I'm starting over again, where I'm basically starting much more as a beginner, and can actually experience that delicious sense of getting better and better at something.
Interesting. I say interesting because the last interview that I just did, I haven't published the episode yet, was with Whitney Johnson and her work around disrupting yourself.
The S-curve.
And the S-curve, right?
Yeah.
So that is so relevant. It's just ironic that'll be the two episodes back to back. So,
but it's also your grandfather. It's also your grandfather and sharpening the saw. What I'm saying is, it's like not only should you sharpen the saw, but maybe you get an entirely new tool and you learn how to use that and keep that, you know, you keep that sharp.
Right. All right. So ending, we got two questions that I ask to every author that comes on. So I'll ask you the two questions and then I want to ask you about your upcoming book too. So for the first question here, for someone who's listening, let's say that has a leadership role at a company, has some influence, what is one practical action step they could take to help move to more, you know, motivation 3.0?
Yeah, I mean, I think I hope this is actionable enough. If it's not, I can give you something else. But I think that one of the most important things is your starting premise. Start with the premise that people can be trusted. Start with the premise that everyone that people care. Start with the premise that people are willing to work hard. Now, that won't be true of everybody, but let them disprove that, because I think that starting with the opposite premise is pernicious. If you start with the premise that people can't be trusted, they're going to shirk, they need to be monitored, that's going to lead you down one path. And I think that starting premise is wrong for most people. So, and I think this is doubly true, Stephen, in the aftermath of the pandemic, when, you know, we had these fears that people couldn't be trusted if they worked at home, if they worked remotely, and tens of millions of people in America, hundreds of millions around the world started working remotely, and it was fine, and they got a lot done. That's a very hard egg to unscramble. And so start with the premise that people can be trusted and let a few of them disprove that, rather than start with the opposite premise. I think that's incredibly, incredibly important.
And I think that is a real practical step someone could take. So last question is around, imagine that you were sitting one-on-one with someone who was just starting off in their career, and they asked you about success, both in terms of what is success and how to be successful. How would you go about answering that individual?
So what is success? I would say, don't ask that question. Don't ask the question, what is success? I would say, work extremely hard. Again, there's as simple-minded as that sounds, there are massive returns to doggedness, and I think that we often overlook that. The second thing that I would say is find something you care about and get really good at it, because the act of getting good at something you care about is inherently satisfying, and if you do that, you're going to be fine. Three, the word that I use with my own kids is contribute. Make a contribution. I don't care what it is. And when I say make a contribution, I don't mean necessarily solve the climate crisis. Well, that's cool if you want to do that. I mean, if you're a poet, write a great poem that moves people. If you are a restaurateur, make a great hamburger that people love and that brings a smile to their face. If you are a physician, you know, get someone to change their behavior so that they are leading a healthier life. I don't care what it is, but make a contribution.
I love it. And then finally, before we wrap up, I was wondering if you may share a little preview to your upcoming book called The Power of Regret. And I'll say, when I hear that title, what goes in my mind, and I don't really know much about the premise of the book yet, but what goes in my mind is I instantly think of like my big regrets in life. And so I'm actually curious how the power of regret. It's a fascinating title. So, you know, if you'd be willing to share maybe just a preview of that coming out, would be awesome.
Sure. So what I did on that book is I looked at, there's a lot of research on regret that I harvested. I also did two big research projects of my own, including something called the World Regret Survey, where I collected regrets from 16,000 people in 105 countries. And so among the core ideas in the book are this philosophy of no regrets, so popular here in the United States of America, is total bunk. Everybody has regrets. They make us human. If we handle them right, they can make us better too. That there's a lot of evidence showing that if we reckon with our regrets, all right? So let's take your, I don't want to sort of divulge all, you know, have you talk about all of your regrets. I'm happy to, but let's say that you have your regrets, all right? So there are different ways that you can approach that. You can say, no regrets, ignore them. That leads to delusion. You could say, oh, I've got these regrets. Oh, that's all I can think of, and you wallow in them. That leads to despair. But if you confront them and if you say, you know, these regrets are telling me something. What is the lesson that I can extract from this and how do I apply it going forward? That ends up being one of the most powerful tools we have. If we properly reckon with our regrets, it's one of the most powerful forward-looking tools we have. Regrets properly reckoned with can help us make better decisions, perform better on almost every kind of task, and deepen our sense of meaning. What's more, there is a systematic way to deal with your regrets. In the science, there's sort of a three-step process where you can actually confront your regrets, disclose them, give yourself greater compassion about them, take a step back from them. And if that weren't exciting enough, Stephen, there's also research in here showing that around the world, people have the same four regrets. It's incredible to me. Over and over again, the same four regrets keep coming up. And those four core regrets end up operating as, in some ways, a photographic negative of the good life. That is, if we understand what people regret the most, we actually understand what they value the most. And so in a weird way, this thing that we often try to avoid, regret, a negative emotion, is in many ways one of the most powerful forces we have to point the way to a good life.
That sounds fascinating and exciting. And Dan, you have a real gift with being able to take topics like this, like human motivation and regret, and I know it'll be a not just a great seller, but have a huge impact. Just because
I hope so.
That's all your work is like that. So that's exciting. When is the release of the book?
That book comes out on February 1st, 2022. But if you're listening to this program before that, it will be available for pre-order from any reputable bookseller.
Awesome. Well, I will definitely do that. And I know many listeners will too. So, well, anyways, Dan, thank you again so much for today. I really enjoyed this conversation. I walk away, you know, from all these episodes energized and excited, but especially so today, just because of your graciousness and taking some time and your insight. So thank you so much.
What a pleasure talking to you. I've really enjoyed it.
Thanks, Dan.